Hello, and welcome to The Report, a companion podcast to The Report, the movie starring Adam Driver, Annette Bening, and John Hamm. As always, I am joined by Daniel Jones, who was the lead investigator and author of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on the CIA's torture program.
Hi, it's Daniel. It's great to be here.
If you are new to the show, I strongly recommend you go back and start with episode one. It will make a lot more sense if you do. And I want to start this episode, as I start the episodes, by playing a clip from the movie. And this scene opens with a representative from the CIA basically saying the agency disagrees with some of the conclusions that you, Daniel, came to in your investigation. And in this particular case, the CIA made this claim that it had stopped a terrorist plot by using information it gathered by torturing a detainee.
So over a number of years, of course, the CIA said that they couldn't obtain intelligence on these matters to thwart plots and capture terrorists without using torture, without using what they called enhanced interrogation techniques. And one of the terrorist plots cited that was done as a result of these EITs is a suspected terrorist by the name of Jose Padilla and associated plotting, this dirty bomb plot. And it's the idea that they were going to do a dirty bomb on the National Mall of Washington, D.C., and that it would irradiate the entire area and make it unlivable. And the CIA knew from the very beginning that the plot was just not feasible. And they also had Jose Padilla's name and all of his identifying information way before they ever used their enhanced interrogation techniques. And they received that information from the Pakistani government. And this scene is describing that.
The agency also disagrees that the detention and interrogation program did not produce unique intelligence that disrupted plots and saved lives. For instance, the identity of Jose Padilla, the dirty bomber. If we hadn't stopped Padilla, this entire area would be radioactive today.
Jose Padilla! Padilla found the instructions for his dirty bomb online. In an article entitled, Making and Owning an H-Bomb is the kind of challenge real Americans seek. It says, fill two buckets with uranium and swing them above your head as fast as possible. It was a joke. As far as we can tell, everything they attribute to EITs they already had, from other sources, from foreign governments, from other methods. They claim they saved lives, but what they really did was make it impossible to prosecute a mass murderer like KSM, because if what we did to him ever came out in a court of law, the case is over. The guy planned 9/11. And instead of going to jail for the rest of his life, the CIA turned him into a recruiting tool for a war we're still fighting.
So this dirty bomb plot was not the only instance that you found of the CIA lying about its torture program, right? What else did you find?
There was just so much misinformation about this program that was provided to the White House, the Department of Justice, and Congress. Of course, the dirty bomb plot was not a real plot. It was not revealed after the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. In fact, Abu Zubaydah provided information on that plotting, and he said, by the way, this isn't a real plot, to an FBI special agent prior to the torture beginning. And then there's all this other misinformation that we document, you know, at least these 20 representations that the CIA cited most frequently. But there's also, even within the CIA, there were individuals that knew that the agency was providing misinformation to the Department of Justice and, in fact, to the President of the United States. President Bush gives this big speech on September 6, 2006. It's the first time that the United States government acknowledges that it had a secret detention program. And President Bush, in his speech, talks about special interrogation tactics that were used against these detainees. Again, a reference to enhanced interrogation techniques, torture, that enabled the CIA to thwart specific plots and capture specific terrorists. And as that speech is happening, there are CIA officers inside the agency discussing what President Bush is saying. And there's this exchange we have in the Senate report whereby one CIA officer says, who told President Bush that enhanced interrogation techniques led to this plot or that? That's not true. The other person basically says, ha, 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 it's probably redacted person one and redacted person two. And then the other person says, agree, we shall pass over in silence. So these are people within the agency who know that the CIA is providing false information to the White House. And their decision is not to go and become a whistleblower and report it up the channels. It is, no, we will pass over in silence.
Wow. So how did you go about figuring out when someone was lying versus when someone was just passing along information that they thought was accurate?
In many instances in the report, we see misinformation from the CIA going to the White House or other entities in Congress. And it's really hard to identify what an individual at the CIA knew. Did that CIA officer, they themselves get bad information? Or did they know what they were providing to Congress was false? So that was really hard to nail down. In one case, we could identify that the CIA officer in question knowingly provided false information, and that was the CIA director. So the CIA is trying to get an accounting. They're trying to wrap their hands around this program, find out how many people they detained. Now, that's a pretty simple question, right? The CIA to this day has no idea how many people they detained. But they had told Congress and White House that it was less than 100. Well, when someone comes to Director Hayden and says, we've got a problem, I've been looking at the records and we've definitely held more than 100 detainees. What are we going to do about this? And Hayden says, no, we've had less than 100 detainees. You pick a date. You pick a date when this program began. We've always had less than 100 detainees. So how do we know that story? It's remarkable. The CIA officer who briefed this new information to the CIA director goes back to his desk, sends an email only to himself, and says, today I briefed the CIA director that we had more than 100 detainees. He told me to keep the number under 100 and pick a date. Right? So this is someone who knows the CIA director is providing false information to the White House and Congress and doesn't do anything about it, but does send an email to themselves, in other words, to absolve themselves of responsibility at some point, right? But it was so hard in so many cases to see where that line was. In this one, it was cut and dry. Clearly, the CIA director knew that the CIA had detained more than 100 people, and they instructed this guy to say, no, keep it under 100, just pick a date.
Did it surprise you that so much of the CIA's actions were documented? I mean, knowing this was such a risky program with this questionable legal foundation, why would CIA agents leave such a staggeringly large paper trail?
So we had 6.3 million pages of records, classified records, right? These were memorandums, they were emails, and also instant messaging. At the time of the agency, most people thought instant messaging wasn't recorded, that we could exchange this chat and that data would go away and would never be in the CIA archives, as opposed to a memo, right, which would be real. We know that's going to be preserved. When the CIA was engaged in torture and torturing detainees, there were many CIA officers who objected about the program, didn't want the CIA to be engaged in what they were doing, or they themselves wanted out. And we talk about this in the report in the Abu Zubaydah interrogations in 2002, where CIA officers are writing to CIA headquarters. These are people in the detention site who are writing and saying, we should stop. We're approaching or exceeding the legal limit of what we can do. We want to treat Abu Zubaydah in a different way. Then later on, there's quotations of the head of the interrogation program at the CIA called it a train wreck and wanted out. So the response we see in the CIA records are CIA headquarters people responding saying, do not put these concerns in writing, right? They did not want a paper trail, identifying the fact that their own officers saw this as ineffective and illegal.
Like I said, there was a paper trail and it was a big one. But one of the most dramatic episodes of this whole saga is the story of one document in particular that the CIA actually tried to hide from you. This was called the Panetta Review. In fact, the report, the movie, begins with this very clandestine-feeling mission where you take this document out of the CIA.
I became very worried that the internal Panetta Review would be destroyed. It had already been taken off our servers. But we had printed out portions of it. And at that point, remember, the CIA destroyed interrogation videotapes. They're not inexperienced at destroying records. And here's the CIA acknowledging themselves all the wrongdoing of this program and really importantly, the ineffectiveness of torture, which, again, all of these things they were denying. So I felt a duty to preserve this document. So it went into a classified bag. It went from a safe at the CIA to a safe in the Senate.
The Panetta Review set off a chain of events that had profound consequences for Daniel and for the country. It sparked an all-out war between the Senate and the CIA. The CIA didn't know that Dan had a copy of the Panetta Review until December 17th, 2013, during a Senate confirmation hearing. And it was one that shocked CIA leaders and the public. Spencer Ackerman, a journalist who covers national security, was watching that hearing on television. Colorado Senator Mark Udall was questioning Carolyn Crass, who President Obama had nominated to be the top lawyer for the CIA.
So in December of 2013, the CIA sends a nominee to be its chief lawyer to the Senate Intelligence Committee, a woman named Carolyn Crass. And these are usually like pretty boring hearings. The Intelligence Committee doesn't do a whole lot of work in public. Among the little that it does in public is hold hearings for agency nominees. So I'm not really looking forward to covering this thing, particularly like this is going to, you know, dwell on a lot of CIA legalese. But, you know, a lot of that is going to be important because the legalese, you know, helps you determine how they view the boundaries of the job. And I sort of, you know, settle in for what's likely going to be a pretty esoteric and forgettable hearing. And then suddenly I learn something that I've never known about the CIA and torture. A senator named Mark Udall revealed something that he describes as a smoking gun, illustrating the CIA's both brutality of the torture program and its lies to Congress, to the public, and to the Bush administration about what the torture program actually is. And all of a sudden, you know, my ears perk up. I didn't really know that such a thing existed. He refers to it as something called the Panetta Review.
Yeah, that was a high-stakes and high-profile hearing.
This is Mark Udall, the former Colorado senator and member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who questioned Carolyn Crass during her confirmation hearing.
I used to climb a lot of high mountains, including some of the highest mountains in the world, and there was a lot of risk-reward involved in climbing on the high peaks. And the feelings in the legislative world, and particularly this particular time, I had those same feelings. I probably wasn't going to die in the hearing or die taking this position. But politically, there were real risks for me. But I knew as this slow walk continued that the CIA itself had internally done a review of what I'm going to call just simply the torture program. Of course, they called it enhanced interrogation. They'd done their own internal review under former director Panetta. And the conclusions that they had reached inside the CIA were identical to the conclusions that Dan Jones and his team, the Senate staffers that worked on this for 6 years, had reached. But the CIA was denying all of this to us as senators in classified and in personal briefings. And I tried on a number of occasions to push John Brennan and others to come clean, to let them know that if they did come clean, that this was going to strengthen the country and it would strengthen the CIA. And it would certainly help me maintain my respect for them as important members of the leadership cadre in the CIA. But it was not forthcoming. So I strategized with Dan Jones, my own staffer, Jennifer Barrett, both of whom are phenomenal public servants, about how we could draw attention to this without breaking the responsibility and even the legal requirements I had to keep classified information classified. One of the backstories of that hearing was I was later threatened with an ethics review by bringing up the Panetta Review in that open committee hearing that because I had somehow in the minds of some senators violated the ethics rules surrounding the way in which the Intelligence Committee worked. We carefully crafted my questions, and I carefully delivered those questions. And that's why the movie, it's so important that my words be exactly what they were in that hearing, so that I didn't break faith with my legal responsibilities on the committee, but I also kept faith with the need to make this report public on behalf of the people of this country and our principles and values as Americans.
And so Senator Udall says he felt like he had no choice but to tell the world about the Panetta Review in a public hearing. And the blowback was fast.
After that hearing where I made it clear that there was a review of this called the Panetta Review that confirmed what the Senate Intelligence Committee staff were discovering in their review and the report they were generating. The drama and the tension and the focus increased dramatically. The CIA broke in to the Senate offices that were located at the CIA, but they were Senate offices. They took all the disks and all the data on the computers from that Senate office. They then quickly moved to accuse Dan Jones of being a criminal, basically. They accused him of removing the Panetta Review from the CIA premises. Dan made the courageous decision because he felt that the CIA was beginning to overstep its legal bounds and was beginning to implement an even larger cover-up. And he took the courageous step of taking that document because it was so important to the whole focus of this study. And I will always have deep admiration for Dan as a public servant who had his eye on the bigger issue here, who had he put his own career at risk. He put his own financial situation at risk. So on one hand, I'm being accused of breaking my legal responsibilities and possibly being censured, and Dan, shortly thereafter, is being charged with criminal activity.
Because Senator Udall decided to announce the existence of the Panetta Review in a public hearing, this whole fight between the CIA and the Senate is now very much out in the open.
And now we have a really dramatic moment in something that's unfolded overwhelmingly behind the scenes. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which tries as hard as it can to cultivate a close working relationship with the intelligence agencies it oversees, has someone saying that the agency has lied to it, that it has proof that the agency itself came to the same conclusions about those lies and about the underlying brutality the lies conceal, and that the Senate knows all of this and it's willing to call it out publicly in order to bring this loggerheads to some kind of resolution. And it was just an extraordinary moment. It ends up having overwhelming consequences that really push this clash between the CIA and the Senate to a precipice. What ends up happening as the result of that is Panetta's successor, John Brennan, Barack Obama's closest intelligence advisor and the director of the CIA now, goes into overdrive to find out how it is that the Senate ever got a hold of this thing, which ultimately it determined Senate investigators were never supposed to have, but, you know, nevertheless possessed. This is exactly the genesis, just weeks later, of what would become the CIA's decision to violate an accord it had with the Senate to bypass firewalls on a shared network that the CIA agreed to set up so it could provide the Senate safely and securely with the work its overseers need to investigate this program, something that had a lot of questionable sanctity, given that in the past, Senate investigators had noticed CIA documentation that they would think was important mysteriously disappearing. That happened in 2010. So now, the CIA, without the Senate knowing, is spying on the Senate. Later, it would deny that it had done any such thing. This would ultimately push Dianne Feinstein, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the driving political force behind the report, to accuse the CIA in public of having crossed something of a constitutional Rubicon. And that colored absolutely everything after March 2014, about the next, you know, 9 months, resulting in the declassification of a sliver of the report, and then an overwhelming fight that the CIA waged to ensure that its narrative would be the one that carried the day and carried the weight of history rather than the Senate's.
I want to put this war between the CIA and the Senate in context, because this dynamic was very different than the one that preceded it. And that was the relationship between the Senate and the NSA in the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks.
So my experience with the way in which the CIA fought with the Senate was at the time filtered through my experience reporting for The Guardian on the leaks we got from Edward Snowden about the NSA and the subsequent months of watching the NSA ensure that it had the rock-solid support of the Senate Intelligence Committee in the face of a public crisis. And it had that support. It had that support in particular from Dianne Feinstein. She defended the NSA to the hilt. Never could I imagine an intelligence agency of comparable stature, really any intelligence agency at all, to decide to go to war with its overseer. It really spoke to how dire the CIA considered the consequences of exposure. And I remember being in a cab, getting a message from a source on Capitol Hill that Feinstein was about to just really lay in to John Brennan and to the CIA over the torture report. And without knowing more, I kind of got the impression that, you know, I should call this up to C-SPAN in order to watch this unfold. And, you know, Feinstein is and is very often described in private by those who know her as a very calm person. And here she was, as animated as I have ever seen her, accusing the CIA of spying on her staff in order to obstruct, which just means in practice, continue to cover up the exposure of a torture program that had now characterized an entire generation of CIA officer. It was just a shocking moment and one that kind of demanded staying on this story for a long time and just finding out how it was that it would unfold. And one of the first things that happened afterwards was Brennan, already scheduled to give a talk at the Council on Foreign Relations, choosing to tell Andrea Mitchell, the moderator, that Feinstein is wrong, that it was preposterous to assert that the CIA had spied on the Senate, and that this was all, you know, something that he implied was a malicious misunderstanding that he was taking umbrage at, that the CIA was being, you know, falsely accused of.
As this story unfolded, more and more journalists started asking questions about what the CIA had done. Who was right? Did Daniel Jones get his hand on a document he wasn't supposed to have? Did the CIA spy on the Senate or not? We know the answers to these questions today, and one of the reasons we know is yet another secret document. This one was discovered by investigative journalist Jason Leopold, who, in the course of his reporting on the CIA, made a documents request to the agency, and they granted it.
When the CIA turned over these records to me, they also happened to turn over a courtesy copy, which I thought was weird. I'm not sure why they did it, but they turned over a courtesy copy of these records to Senator Feinstein. I thought that was odd. And so I'm going through all these records, and they're very technical. These are very, very technical records that describe the way in which these computer systems are set up. And there was a letter in there. And this was a letter that John Brennan had written to, drafted to Senator Feinstein and her Republican counterpart on the committee, Saxby Chambliss. And the letter essentially said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, yes, you're right, we did spy on the committee, and I apologize, you know, recognize the importance of, you know, of this matter. I'm committed to correcting the shortcomings, you know, that this report revealed. I apologize for the actions that we took going into, you know, the Senate's computers. It was a letter that Dianne Feinstein never received. So I called up the CIA, you know, obviously the Office of Public Affairs. I said, hey, you know, I got these records and I wanted to talk to you about this one letter that was written by John Brennan, but it was not signed. It was an unsigned letter. And it's my understanding that Dianne Feinstein never received it. So I get a call back from the folks and they say, hey, Jason, yeah, we got your message. So listen, about that letter, we accidentally turned that over to you. That was a mistake, and we'd appreciate if you did not write about it or post it. I remember saying to them, I hear you, and I hung up the phone. And all I know is at that moment, this letter was, you know, going to be the centerpiece of the story because it underscored – all the lies that were being told. And then in addition to that, you know, I spoke to my editor. I said, we need to prominently display this letter. So if you go onto the story page, you know, you can see this letter is just this, you know, out there. It's just a posted right in the middle of the story. But it really made clear that, you know, this and all these other documents that were released, you know, it backed up this extraordinary floor statement, right? Because there were questions about, you know, is this true? Is that true? Nobody knew who to believe at this point. You know, it was very easy to not believe the CIA, but also it just sounded just crazy that they would, you know, that they would do this. And here was this letter. And this letter said all that you needed to know about what took place.
Amazon Studios' The Report is produced by Topic Studios and Western Sound. Executive producers for Topic Studios are Maria Zuckerman, Letal Molad, and Lisa Limegang. Special thanks to Lizzie Jacobs. Executive producer for Western Sound is Ben Adair, and the producer is David Weinberg. Hannes Brown composed original music and mixed the show. Daniel Jones is executive producer and host. I'm Kelly McEvers. Thanks for listening. Next time on The Report, the story of what happened after the torture report was completed. That was only the beginning of a new fight to get it released to the public.